And that was something with three words in the title.
NSYNC, bye, bye, bye.
NSYNC, bye, bye, bye. And that's it for Ear Buddies this week. And we're going to switch it up a little bit with mostly talk, some music, socialist alternative radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. Thinking of changing the name of the show to Socialist Radio. I don't know why. I mean, lots of reasons why, but, you know, don't want to get into them right now. But anyway, yeah, we're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and you're listening to WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform Commercial-Free Community Radio. And we're a little slice of that community base, also known as Freeform Radio, by the way. We're not Freeform. I like the name. I like the way it sounds. But it's that means the whole situation here, the whole catalog, the whole range of shows. There's no one theme for WMFO. It's all sorts of different shows, music, talk, different types of music, different types of talk. It's all pretty good, and you should give it a listen at WMFO.org, WMFO.org, if you want to listen by the any way other than on the internet. But we also have the live, actually out in the air radio signal, which I really like, by the way. And that's supposed to be owned by the people, speaking of socialist radio or socialist alternative radio here. We're supposed to own that stuff. Clearly we don't. Clearly the corporations own it. And there's a few little low watt stations like this one, although no criticism intended. It's just the way it ended up. Well, actually criticism intended for the larger powers that be, not for anyone involved with WMFO. But, you know, the relatively low watt stations to the left of your dial, clustered on the left usually, where college stations usually, and we're plugging away at some alternative programming. But the vast majority of the airwaves go to, capitalism, basically. Go to, you know, big corporations pushing, the latest product they want you to consume, the latest view of the world that, you know. And I was just thinking about this on the way in. You know, we really truly live in topsy-turvy land, or whatever the right word phrase would be, where social parasites, the completely idle, control the world economy, including in the United States, the capitalists who hire other people to do everything. Believe me, to do everything. All their thinking, all their thinking in terms of decision-making, really comes from people that know a lot more than they do, but just the ones that don't have their signatures on the ownership forms, you know, and are not CEOs. I mean, they'll hire consultants and accountants and engineers and designers. And, you know, if you look at a product, a commodity under capitalism, and you think it's, you know, comes from the head of Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, you're living in a fantasy world. You know, they might have, had the capital. They did have the capital to control certain aspects of production. And I mean control, not create, not do, right? So the people that actually create and the people that actually do are screwed out of their slice of the pie, not because it's unique corruption to Microsoft or Apple or whatever, but really due to the way capitalism works on a daily basis. The people that actually do the work, that actually contribute to society, that keep us going, that are part of a huge web of labor that really runs society, not in terms of control again, but in terms of really making things work, making things go. That is us, the working class, and the social parasites, the completely idle, are sitting at the top controlling huge amounts of wealth. So it's truly, truly wrong, truly unfair, truly topsy-turvy land. Doesn't make any sense. And I was thinking, why was I thinking about that? So I was thinking about arguments, common arguments against socialism, against, if you want to call it communism or democratic socialism, whatever phrase. This is a system, an economic system not run along the lines of capitalism. Doesn't mean I'm talking about, by the way, Stalinist Russia or Maoist China, which was came out of Stalinism in a lot of ways. I'm talking about moments in history, short, relatively brief moments in history, where the working class has gained control, shown that things can be run democratically. The beginning of the Russian Revolution, for example, in horrible conditions, coming out of World War I and so on. But there was that. There were these big workers' organizations called Soviets, which just means councils, doesn't mean what it meant later. And Spanish Civil War, parts of Spain, as they were fighting off a fascist invasion, they liberated parts of the country and started to run things in some parts of the country in a more equal way. Again, scarce resources, relatively speaking, but showed that society could be run. Even something like the Seattle General Strike, which was a little over a week strike in Seattle, Washington, 1919, and the unions were running the show, running town, without the capitalists, things running well. The Paris Commune, a month and a half about, or a little over a month, early on in the history of capitalism, 1871, people taking over, running things. I'm not talking about like when I say commune, it's not like, I'm talking about like commune, hippie commune or something, God bless it. But I'm not talking about like something, I don't believe in God, so I don't know why I said that. But anyway, you see how deep the early Catholicism can be in your brain, how deep that can go in your brain. But anyway, I'm not criticizing people that try to live in socially alternative ways in microcosm, which is basically what a commune is. And I'm not talking about, anarchistic views of communes. And way, way back when I was a kid, I used to be an anarchist, so... I know what I'm talking about when I mention those, because I was fascinated by that stuff and would read a lot about it. Not talking about those little efforts to hollow out capitalism, which never, ever works. Richard Wolff, pay attention, please. I'm talking about the Paris Commune was an entire city and parts around it controlled by the people for a time where they had to figure out how to defend themselves against the French army, backed by the German army at the time, and build and figure out how to get what they needed at the same time as they were defending themselves, and figure out, and since they were liberating themselves, they were trying to figure out, how do we have freedom? How do we be free, from capitalism, and be truly free for the first time, and came up with ways to enact that were cut short by blood, by murder, by massacre, which is the way a lot of the ways capitalism reasserts itself on a daily basis around the world, but also at moments of bigger conflicts as well. So I'm sitting there thinking, going back to the original point, of common arguments against socialism, and there's that one which is based on the myth of, people, lazy people collecting welfare and all that kind of, right-wing garbage. But it's based on, a general idea inculcated into our minds, we're brainwashed, myself as well, about what work is, right? So, work for for our families that we do voluntarily, volunteer work we do. I'm using the word volunteer, okay? Volunteer work we do for others. The way people help each other in a solidaristic way. That's a weird word, but it's using solidarity. They help each other in times of crisis, like a big hurricane or whatever. Wildfires in California, plenty of stories of heroic acts by ordinary people, average people. All the ways that people do things for each other that are not based on the coercion of work or starve, work or be homeless, work for this big corporation in a certain way, or never work again at that level, at least, or maybe never work again. All the things that you have to do, anyway, everyone knows this, that has gotten a job. And a lot of people try to get jobs. They try to sell their labor. They're not able to. But capitalism is basically about selling your labor to a capitalist, not necessarily an individual, but a group of capitalist individuals forming a corporation that have a corporation, control over a corporation. And they're buying your labor time, your labor power. In a lot of cases, they don't really care what your skills are. They make a big deal about skills. What they really want is control you, basically, that during the time that you're working for them. What you actually do is going to change, probably, often does. And they want skills that are usually a little different from what they advertise for. And that includes the ability to make you do what they want you to do ever faster, with fewer coworkers, adapt to continual change. They think that's a phrase they use in corporations, continual change. Now, there's a tiny grain of truth in that. Things are always changing. That's part of actually Marxist methodology, looking at things through a dialectical materialist way. Things are always changing. What processes are at work? What's happening with those changes? And how to respond to them is a big part of actually Marxist methodology of trying to figure things out, where things are going politically and economically, and where and how history has developed historical materialism, applying dialectics to that. But under capitalism, for a capitalist, they don't really care about the fact that things are always changing, including their own situation in society, and the fact that that will change in the history. That will change in the future, in ways they can't even imagine. They don't even think about really much. But for people, that continual change corporate slogan actually just means we want to keep you precarious in your position. We want to keep you afraid. We want to keep you coward. We want, COWERED, however you spell that. We want to keep you looking only at yourself. Selfish. We want to keep you from discovering that you add value, as do all your coworkers, to a process that you don't control, and that you don't get the full value, even close to the full value of what you produce in that process for whatever commodity is coming out of that, whether it's a thing or a service or whatever. And so we start, having ideas about work ingrained into our heads, whether we like it or not. And some people see through it, some don't. Some see the coercion inherent in capitalism, that, work for this capitalist the way they want you to work and what they want you to work on. I thought, for example, when I got a job at a university, I work at Harvard University, when I got a job there, I thought, and I got it when I was quite young, and I didn't test this knowledge, I didn't understand fully what I was, the knowledge, what I'm about to say, the phrase I'm saying, at least there's no... I'm not working like a lot of my relatives had to in factories, making things didn't necessarily go to good things, military related things, nuclear power stuff, I don't have that direct, I don't have that blood on my hands, right? Well, I was very wrong, of course, because then when I figured out, by becoming a socialist, by becoming a Marxist, figuring out the role that a corporation like Harvard, and is a corporation, plays in the system, in the capitalist system, is extremely important. And they actually, through direct investments, under the cover of being a nonprofit, they still directly invest in corporations. There's tons of blood on their hands. So there's no the fossil fuel protests happening. Anti-fossil fuel protests happening at Harvard, trying to get Harvard to divest from fossil fuels, is just one example of many things Harvard does to hurt the environment, to keep prop up capitalism, the Harvard Business School and so on, and ruling class, educating a wing of the, educating a part of the ruling class. They're there mainly to replicate the ruling class as what, or parts of it, as well as other big education corporations, otherwise known as Ivy League institutions or other schools like that, MIT or whatever. And so there's this idea about work that we have, that everything from our educational system, not ours, by the way, should be ours, but the educational system under capitalism, et cetera, puts into our heads. And, so we're at work knocking ourselves out, usually in unorganized ways, that we don't learn to control the pace of work. That's one of the great things about unions, is that working people actually are smart. We're not stupid. We might be ignorant a lot of the time about things, but we're not stupid. So something that our livelihoods depend on, we figure that stuff out pretty quick. And we figure it out, basically, also, by the way, hate to give our secrets out over the airwaves, but we figured out with help from our coworkers, basically, figured out a lot of stuff with help from our coworkers, help from our families, you know. You know, training is usually crap at a job. You got to figure stuff out on your own, but on your own really means you're getting some help somewhere from coworkers or whatever, which I like. I think that's good. I help people. People help me. That's it. We survive. In a good union, in a healthy union, a strong union, that solidarity with each other becomes a way to actually regulate the pace of work, because if the capitalists have their way, they work you to death. They just do that. Or they work you till you can't stand anymore and the turnover is so high that it's the death of your livelihood, if not your physical death. I was in the situation where I started working in a unionized factory when I was 17 years old, you know, and I was this skinny little kid that they didn't want to hire me at first because I was too small, too young, you know. Other workers that knew me in the factory and in the clerical unit of the factory, they pushed, they got me hired. I'm in the union. I want to prove myself as a good worker. So what do? Like a good American brainwashed worker, you know. I work my butt off, right? I do dangerous things I shouldn't have been doing. In retrospect, I'm, you know, using my 17-year-old body the way a 17-year-old body can be used, you know, going in and within 20 minutes being soaked in sweat in this factory and doing that for the whole day, wolfing down my lunch, doing it for the rest of the day. And finally, you know, someone comes over and says, you know, you're trying to work yourself out of a job? What? You're trying to work yourself out of a job? No, you know, and we had a discussion about, you know, what the situation was at work. And it wasn't the mean thing at all. This person was just, you know, actually teaching me, you know, Socratic method. You're trying to work yourself out of a job? Question. No, I'm not. I need this job really bad. This job's going to let me go to college, you know. And I learned real quick. And it got to the point really fast when I'm like only 18 or 19. I'm seeing new people come in of whatever age. And I'm like trying to figure out a way to talk to them and say, slow down, you know? And I know that this is anathema. This is an insult, a horrible thing to say for many people that work their butts off without thinking about what that means. Who are they working for? What's that doing to them and their families, et cetera, you know? And all I can say is wake up, you know? It'd be easier to wake up if they were in a union, a good union. Not all unions do this. My current union is everyone is atomized for the most part, and the unionership is completely trying to be partners with management, so it's almost like there's no union there. The clerical union at Harvard is a joke, a huge joke. Better than no union, don't get me wrong, but still, in terms of its potential, it's completely not lived up to it. I helped organize it. I was one of hundreds of people that helped organize it originally, and I'm so disappointed in that and what happened to it. They had a hidden philosophy of jointness with management, partnership with management. So you know, there's people get laid off. That's fair. People can get sped up in their workplace. That's fair. Oh, the latest thing that's fair at Harvard, by the way, not the latest. They've been doing this for a while, but. In their largesse, they give you some time off, like right the day before Thanksgiving, day before Christmas, for example. You know, if you don't want to use your vacation time, which is, really, really important to a lot of people, especially if you have a family, you need that vacation time to cover things that otherwise would cost you money, right? So you're out there doing the vacation thing, and I'm sorry, not doing the vacation thing. You're out there working as much as you can. As much as possible, and of course, it totally sucks working the day before Thanksgiving. And of course, I was doing it, and Harvard did this thing which they do without warning. Can't depend on it. They said, okay, you can go home at 1 p.m. They tell people the day before, and it's just, so that's a good thing. That's, you know, paternalistic corporate largesse. We won't turn it down. We'll go for it. You know, still had to come in, still had to do the commute and everything, and so people come in and work. People hear this after they've already put in their time. Another thing Harvard has done is it tries to get you to put your time in for the week really, really soon. So instead of like a card that you punch into a machine like I used to do, a time card, you're just basically doing it online, right? You're doing it on a form they have on a computer, but they often want you to do it like days before the end of the week, you know. for their own accounting purposes. But really, there's an insidious thing going on there, which is you're basically saying, no matter what happens, I'm not going to take this time off. Now, they can adjust time up to a certain point, but there's a certain point where they'll just say, no, you know, you can't change that or whatever, you know. And then the way people think about it is they think about it as a fixed thing, even if it doesn't have to totally be 100%. It's kind of a little bit nuanced, but still a thing that is very, very coercive. Instead of like, hey, if you want to do that, Harvard, then pay us every week. Don't make us wait 2 weeks for our checks, by the way. Or three, it used to be 3 weeks sometimes. Or, hey, you want us to do our time ahead of time, you have to make create a system where it's completely flexible, where in retrospect people can change things or whatever. So this 1 p.m. thing, how does that factor in? Well, everyone's told, hey, you go home at 1 p.m., you go home at 1 p.m., but those of you that have done your time already, tough luck. If you put in for vacation tomorrow because we asked you to do your time early, too bad. Right? How fair is that? Fair? It's not fair. It's not fair at all. It's horrible. Actually, it's taking, giving with one hand, taking away with the other, which is classic Harvard, classic American corporation, classic international capitalism. Give with one hand, take away with the other, and that takeaway hand is always taking a lot more than the hand that's giving. And by the way, the hand only gives on the other hand because of, you know, pressure from unions, basically pressure from workers' parties, socialist, labor, communist parties. Whatever their name, where they exist, to create any kind of reforms, any kind of mood in society that we're owed something, that we do, you know, because we run society, we're owed a little bit back, which we should have the whole pie, not just crumbs. But even the crumbs come only where there's pressure. I just saw a thing on the internet today where there's protests in Pakistan about economic conditions, including child labor, right? And you've probably read, I hope you have read, that there's still slavery still exists in some countries. You know, I mean, if you know, there was this thing in the United States. Now, granted, this is an anomaly at this point in time. I hope I'm not inadvertently lying here. But as far as I know, there's not a lot of child labor in the United States. I'm sure there's some, and that's horrible. But, you know, there was this picture of a 8-year-old working at a Popeyes or something like that, or an 8 or 9-year-old working at a Popeyes because their new chicken sandwich is supposedly so popular, blah, blah. They threw this kid in the back to work at the Friars or whatever, you know, and it was caused a scandal because someone got on their cell phone. Good, right? But good that they got on the cell phone. Good, it caused a scandal. But there's an illustrative thing there. There's a lesson there, which is, hey, you know, you think you're safe from child labor in this country because we, you know, got laws passed against it and so on. Hey, they'll claw those laws back. You know, there used to be laws as recently as, I mean, still on the books, actually, a law that says if you go on strike in this country, they can't permanently replace your job with another worker. They can't do that. And, of course, for example, with the PATCO strike in 1981 or whenever it was when ray guns got into power, and this was based on a lot of stuff that the Carter administration had done, so I'm not giving the Democrats have passed. The Carter administration did a lot of anti-union stuff and did a lot of deregulation, which really hurt unions. Reagan came in and continued a lot of those policies. And he didn't invent them. But one thing that happened, and it has happened before Reagan, but he brought it back, was to say, oh, yeah, there's this law. It says, you can't have permanent replacements of striking workers. Well, we're going to ignore that law. We're going to just replace all the air traffic controllers with scabs. And that's what they did. And then a lot of other unions started to do that, realizing that the government would look the other way, whether it was a Republican administration or a Democratic administration controlling the NLR, National Labor Relations Board, starting with that precedent, quote unquote, set by Reagan, which actually, again, there was precedent for it before that, unfortunately. They went ahead and ignored that law, which is still on the books, still a law under the National Labor Relations Act from 1938, I believe, that you can't have permanent replacements to strikers. But now, every time that comes up, every court will just rule against that law, even though the law exists. So what I'm trying to say is that the laws don't guarantee anything under capitalism. They one law for the rich, one law for the poor, old cliche, absolutely true. Absolutely true in my experience, by the way, including as a paralegal, etc. Absolutely true, unfortunately. And that's not going to change until we have a different economic system, until we have socialism, democratic socialism. But getting back to the original point of the ideas about work that we're brainwashed about, you know, you work really hard, you'll get ahead, the Horatio Alger myth, all that stuff, American Dream myth. Check out George Carlin for some really real wisdom on the American Dream. For example, you have to be asleep to believe it, but there's other choice words he had for big business and the American Dream and all that. And what we're taught, work hard, you'll get ahead, blah, blah. I know a lot of people see through that, but I don't mean just see through it in a cynical way, which is good. That's fine. Not all cynicism is bad. But I mean see through it in a way that, wow, this is really unfair, really wrong, and it's destroying the planet. And as far as human habitation goes, it's destroying our livelihoods, are precarious, our living standards are often going down. I don't know if you just read recently, but life expectancy in the United States has dropped for 3 years in a row. They're like, why is this happening? You know, and there's different theories thrown around, it might have something to do with the crappy healthcare system, the system for profit. There was just a doctor on national propaganda radio as I was coming in, that's supposedly in a sort of milk toasty way, very kind of wimpy way, is part of a group of doctors resisting a big hospital in Virginia or West Virginia, I can't remember which one, that some reporters, some journalists discovered that they're suing their patients so horribly for unpaid medical bills that they're forcing people out of their homes. You know, it's sort of like the old debt slavery thing, another thing that seemed to have been gone, consigned to the early stages of capitalism, some sort of Dickensian thing that's actually happening in the United States right now with medical debt and other forms of debt, but especially medical debt, a lot of people going bankrupt because of medical debt. So in a system this messed up where people can't get the care they want because they can't afford it, or they're afraid to even try because they can't afford it, that you have a situation where that might be why, one huge reason living standards are falling. But actually, I would agree with some arguments that it's even more than that. Probably it's the way the food is produced for profit, and in an unhealthy way. It's the fact we don't have enough leisure time to keep our bodies and our minds, in many cases, in terms of the dementia spreading and all that, in shape and sharp. We're just used for work and then thrown away. If we can't sell our labor, intellectual labor, physical labor, both combined, whatever, then we are consigned to deep, deep poverty that has its own ways of killing you off, whether it's freezing to death because you're homeless, or whether it's, again, not being able to get proper medical care. It's a vicious circle. So anyway, we get these ideas about work that are really untrue if you look at them sort of mathematically, if you look at them sort of throughout the population. You know, the number of people that work hard that get ahead, quote unquote, whatever that means exactly. Let's say it means a certain level of income, certain level of things that you own. That gets smaller and smaller. And I'm not just talking about like a pyramid where there's like a, I'm talking about like a really, really, I've seen the graphs. There's like this huge, think of a pyramid, but instead of a gradual rise to the top, it's really just a base and then a flagpole, you know, a very thin line of people getting that make it anywhere in this society, and under capitalism in general, compared to the vast numbers of people there are, you know, compared to the population. So you have this thin line going up, 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 and that's of course complete inequality if you have someone like way, way above, or a few thousands of people way, way above everybody else by just unimaginable amounts of money and other things, other ownership things, that this intense inequality, which people are doing studies on that in public health studies and so on, that in itself kills people, right? Not just the concrete things you can measure, but things that they're not quite sure about, but just that there's a correlation, you know? Inequality tends to kill. More unequal societies are more unhealthy societies, et cetera, et cetera. The more unequal, the more unhealthy. So anyways, a lot of this stuff we learn about work is really dead wrong, but it's based on something that forces us to do work, to work hard for people we don't want to work hard for, but we must, because we must sell our labor to survive under capitalism, or try to. And it's a very, very coercive system. inherently violent. I mean, just go. I mean, just think of any art or decent sociology or Marxist writing or socialist writing about capitalism, and it's so obvious. But you have to say it sometimes. You have to, because people say, "Oh, I," you know, people think their every step in their life is this voluntary step in a completely free way. And when you look at, when you trace the steps, you can see exactly why each choice was made and how that was set up by their class background or by something that happened that got them away from their class background temporarily. Then they lucked out here, they got this there, and they, you know. So whether it's the so-called success, or whether which is tiny statistically, or whether it's the failure, quote unquote, which isn't really failure, it's just surviving in a way. It's a victory in a sense of the system is so horrible. Then you see you can materially figure this stuff out. I mean, people have done social mobility studies, by the way. All the social mobility studies they've been doing on the U.S. that I'm aware of show the U.S. since about the 80s, when they really first started doing these things in a big way, in a more scientific way. They show the United States lagging in social mobility, meaning going from, you know, working class to real middle class, not what we're taught in this country that everyone working class is middle class. Middle class really means you're a small owner, a small business owner, whether it's a legal firm, a doctor consortium, and you're part owner of that or something, some doctor business, or you're running a small store or a small farm or something like that. You know, that's middle class. And middle class is very, very fluid. A lot of them drop back into the working class. A very select few manage to survive, which always happens under capitalism, the tendency for the concentration of capital or monopolization to happen. They get bought up. Maybe they get some money from that. They become one of the big capitalists. Maybe they just get bought up and disappear from the scene or whatever, or they get forced out of business or whatever. So middle class is fluid, and politically fluid too. See them going either way a lot of the time. You know, like you'll have times where, say, small farmers in the history, which are disappearing, small farmers in the history of this country, there are times where they contributed to their own demise by supporting right-wingers like Trump or whoever, based on some immediate expedient they think they're going to get, or Democrats, doesn't matter if they're supporting Republicans or Democrats, they're supporting capitalist parties, and through some sort of immediate expedient they're going to get in terms of some trade deal or something. But meanwhile, the basic system of capitalism, you know, of debt to having to go into debt to pay for things to harvest or to buy more land or whatever, buy seed, whatever. This all compounds, and a lot of farmers go out of business. They can't handle it, especially in competition with big agribusinesses, right? Obviously. So, but there have been times where farmers caught on, at least for a short time, and they organized with the left. They organized with, for example, in the 30s with the Communist Party and others. They overcame racial lines. They overcame their competition with each other. And there's other times as well where that's happened, but there's unfortunately a lot of times like now where it doesn't happen, not that I'm aware of at least. I hope there's some farmers organizing in a progressive way, and I'm sure there are somewhere, but there's very few farmers left. But that's just one example. A lot of small businesses disappear, right? Remember, you know, the old, or they almost disappear under monopolization and concentration of capital, which is constant under capitalism. But again, going back to the theme of, you know, basic work, we are coerced into labor under capitalism, the labor that pays anything, at least. And that is, you know, if you don't sell your labor, if you don't try to sell your labor, then you won't get either pay, which is never, again, the full value or even close to it of what you are producing for the what you're contributing in terms of value contributed to the creation of a commodity of some sort, a good or a service, a thing or a service to be sold. Or you try to sell your labor, you can't make it, but there are rules by the government controlled by capitalism about how much money you will get then if you cannot sell your labor. And it's never enough, you know, Social Security or disability or whatever, never enough to really survive on. So you're stuck there. And if you can't get those things, can't get any sort of payment from the government or not enough, and you're going to end, which is very, very much the case around the U.S. and in other countries as well, you end up homeless. and that is a or you feel like you have to commit a crime to survive and you end up in prison, you know. And these are very real, real fears of a lot of working people that, you know, they've done studies recently, of course, you probably read about them. You know, X number of Americans, it's millions and millions, tens of millions are one paycheck away from going more into debt or to survive, or one check away from really having a domino effect of missing certain payments, like on a house or whatever, or rent, and ending up homeless, and not being able to pay for a medical emergency or whatever. There's all sorts of angles on these studies that come out, these sociological studies, showing that even in a so-called time of low unemployment, although the figures are cooked, and a so-called boom in the economy, people are still, most people are really suffering. When I say suffering, it doesn't mean like some sort of cliche of always, you know, weeping and rending, tearing our clothes and, you know, pulling our hair out and so on. It just means that you don't see a future. You don't see, and you're just counting the days to when something bad's going to happen and you're not going to be able to handle it. Or, yeah, you're in deep trouble and you're sleeping on couches, you're trying to survive, you're desperately selling your labor for jobs that don't pay enough, even when you cobble together two or three jobs. They don't pay enough because unions have gotten weaker. There's no workers' party in the United States, so wages are really depressed. And even the corporate media talks about wages not keeping up with inflation, especially when you look at certain types of inflation. Wages not keeping up with going up at all, being stagnant or decreasing. After the Great Recession, so-called 2007, 2008 into 2009, jobs, people that lost their jobs regaining jobs, the jobs they regained paying less. So you add all this stuff up, and you know, working hard is, under capitalism, is no guarantee of anything for the vast majority of people. You might luck out, you might step on some skulls to get to the top, if you didn't start there. But most of the time, you start at the top, and you stay there. If you're one of the quote unquote successful ones under capitalism, and very few people are led into that club, you know. Again, check out George Carlin. He talks about capitalism and the in America, and it's big business, a club that we're not a part of, etc. I can't get into it too much because of the language he used, which I really enjoyed. But you know, there's a capitalist-based rules on not swearing in the media. But anyway, so what I'm going back to that original point of, so work is very, very different in the way we think about it than what we actually do, because most people will actually help other people. Most people will do, with a lot of stress because of the jobs that we get from the capitalists, if we're able to, and I don't say get from the capitalists, we actually create those jobs with our labor. But they control them. So if we're able to sell our labor, then especially in this country with the weakened unions and so on, no workers' party, there's we like Americans are working longer hours than any other industrialized country, right? Any other sort of advanced capitalist country, quote unquote. Advanced in capitalism is kind of don't go together, but let's just throw that out there. And so overtaking Japan a number of years ago, like 5 years ago. So how much time do you have left over for your family or for just your own personal well-being, cleaning, exercising? Ha. I've said this before on the show, like I go to the doctor and the doctor says, hey, you should exercise more. And I'm like, okay, so you get me 10 hours more a week. You pay for the gym. You get 10 more hours off from work per week without no reduction in pay. You pay for the gym. And because this is all money that, you know, I'm just going to go to my kids or something. It's not going to go for me unless something new happens, right? Like the money I make without that 10 hours of free time is going to be work time, right? And that's going to be money I make. It's going to go to my kids, my family, surviving. Don't have time, money for the gym, commute. Hey, that's the commute time is the gym time, right? I'm commuting. So, okay, so somehow make transportation better in the worst city in the country, Boston. For transportation now, in terms of volume, clogging up everything, and privatized commuter rail, ruining everything, and so on. Won't go into that right now. But anyway, so you do all these things that will allow me to exercise, which is all based on money, which I don't have, and time, which I don't have, because I have to use my time to make money. That's the coercive part of capitalism, right? That, no, there's not going to be much exercise or hardly any, you know? It's just not going to happen. Like, we just had 4 days off, right? A lot of people in this country, Thanksgiving, a lot of people get the day after off. That's why it's called Black Friday, by the way. This is shopping day in the United States. If you think about it concretely, materialistically, as a good Marxist should, as a good socialist should, in a country where there's notoriously low amounts of vacation time for workers, and many workers don't have any vacation time, when are you going to shop? Right? When are you going to shop? What, you know, you're exhausted. You might work weekends, you know? I mean, there's, you know, when do you have time to shop, really? You don't have much time. Oh, but wait a minute. Then there's this Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, which a lot of people get off. Watch that change. And that's already changing. A lot of retail workers, of course, are laughing now, right now, because they have to work on Friday. But, and a lot of other people. But a certain number of workers, more than normal, even around Christmas time, you don't get as much time off. Guaranteed. I mean, not guaranteed. It's not guaranteed, but I mean, usually, in terms of what's happening right now and the recent past. So a lot of workers get Friday off, so there's a lot of shopping done. It's a really easy calculation, a really easy thing to fit, you know, correlation right there. Boom. A day off, oh my goodness, you don't usually get many days off. A day off that's not technically a holiday, right? It's the day after a holiday. So boom, you're going to have a ton of shopping done, right? I don't care what it is. It doesn't have to even be presents. It can just be like, oh, now I got time to like get the tires fixed or something, or, you know, or now I got time to buy a winter coat or some shoes, you know? I mean, this is going to be my third winter without boots of any sort. I got these old, I don't want to get into it. I got these old shoes that are falling apart. I kind of wear, but now I've learned to, you know, when you shovel snow, you know, I really try to stick to like, you know, not stepping, not accidentally or whatever, stepping out of the path I'm shoveling so I don't freeze to death. My feet don't freeze to death. Anyway, blah, blah. We all have our crosses to bear, but see that we shouldn't. See, that's part of that. Again, I said earlier in the show, that early Catholic brainwashing I got. No, we don't have all our crosses to bear, because some people aren't bearing any crosses. The people at the top control everything. No, they got no crosses, right? They got control. They got wealth. They got hire the people to shovel their driveways, you know, or shovel their walks or whatever, you know? It's not fair. It's not right. But getting back, and we're going to end this in a minute, the whole work thing, right? We got it backwards, right? We're always blaming each other. Someone didn't work hard enough in the workplace. Someone on welfare didn't work hard enough, you know, which is crap. Right? Hardest thing to do, most work there is to be poor in this country. And when we say workers, by the way, on this show, working people, includes everybody that has to work or try to work, including people that haven't worked for a long time, or retired people that are working class, or young people that are working class that haven't got a job yet. It's a very wide definition. It has to be a wide definition of working class, because that's how the system functions. It's going to be sucking new people in, going to be tossing old people out, exploiting old people beyond retirement age, the newest thing here in the United States. Forget about retirement for millions and millions of workers. I saw a thing in the corporate media, McDonald's replacing teenage workers with older workers. You know, and I mean older, I mean like post-retirement or around retirement age. Post-retirement age or around retirement age, around 67, 65, 60, 70, 75, if they last that long, whatever. And people having to take those jobs to survive. And that's wrong. They've been worked to death already. They've been worked hard. When do you get to enjoy things? You know, you start working. A lot of people start working in their teens. You know, I did. I started when I was 17. Only time I got any time off in my head, wasn't really time off, but it was kind of time off, was college. You know, and college can be really hard, especially now, really, really difficult. But compared to working, it's better. It's a lot better than working. And then, you know, people, of course, a lot of people going to college and working at the same time. Because I had a union factory job when I wasn't, I'd work, you know, summers, I worked a year, I worked summers, I worked during holidays. I got to the point where I didn't have to work at school. And that was a big blessing, right? That was a really good thing. So, that's some time off. And then when I graduated, had a little money saved up. I spent about 4 months not working. Then I was unemployed, right after that, which really hurt. I came back from overseas into a recession. And then there was another time I was unemployed. And that scares the crap out of you. There's no, because I had no cushion. I had nowhere to go. That was really, really scary. And that's more coercion. That's part of that coercion. You know, if you're ever unemployed and you find out, oh, you only get half your check if you jump through these hurdles. And oh, some people will try to screw you. Some companies will try to screw you out of unemployment altogether. And, oh, a lot of situations you don't qualify for unemployment based on the laws written to help the businesses more than the people that are unemployed. Blah, blah, blah. You know, boy, that'll put the fear of capitalism into you fast. Unemployment. And it did, you know. And people wonder why I've stayed at a job for so long. Well, you know, the things that I like to do, capitalism doesn't really pay for. The things that I would want to do for a living, capitalism doesn't really pay for much. And when they do, it's like a miracle that someone, you know, is successful in that way. And then there's the fact of the oh yeah, I kind of remember being unemployed. That might have something to do with it. Also, job interviews. Oh my God, I hate job interviews. You know, I mean that's, you know, not one of the main reasons I would suffer through them like everybody else. But the look, you just want to smack that smile off of their face so fast. You know, and those HR people that are cops for big business, you just want to just be like, what are you doing? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? Oh, let's say, well, if I'm not homeless, I might be working here for really low pay and surviving barely like I already have, or having my labor exploited more. How's that for an answer? You gonna hire me now? But no, you have to come up with something that fits into their paradigm, the way they look at life. Well, I'm gonna work my way up to help you exploit other people really badly and pollute more the environment and so on. And I'll do whatever you want me to do to, you know, so you'll make more money. I'll fire people. I'll do whatever you want. Just please hire me. And I'll go up the career ladder, you know. And of course, the ladders don't exist, or they're very narrow. But if you do manage to squeeze your way into a narrow career ladder and get up there, you have to do some really rotten things that I don't want to do. I'm not going to do them. I have my limits, you know, and my limits aren't how crappy a job is necessarily, although I'm sure I have those limits too, but I've, you know, done some really crappy jobs. My limits are, I'm not going to crap on other workers. That's my limits. I'm not going to be a supervisor. I'm not going to be a boss. That's my limit, you know. I mean, I'm supervising students. Even that kind of disgusted me, you know, and I would be like, nah, I'm not really your supervisor. They just call me that. Here's what we need to do. Let's work it out. You know, I'm doing the same thing they are, just as much as they, just as long as they were, you know, whatever. Oh man. So anyway, the work thing, topsy-turvy world, capitalism world, the people that do the least amount of work or zero amount, they're the capitalists and they run the show. And the people that do all the work and who look at each other and say, hey, the person next to me is not doing enough work, don't look up, but for the most part, and see the people that are doing no work but are pulling the strings, not even pulling the strings, getting others to pull the strings to make you work more and to, you know, make you feel like you have choices where they weren't really choices. They were pre-engineered pathways, algorithms working, could be worked out to show you what you did. And you know, your supposed free will under capitalism was very constricted or non-existent, depending on your circumstances. And circumstance is even the wrong word for it, depending on your class and what was happening at that time historically and so on in the class struggle. So again, it goes back to that daydream I had about, like, you know, people are going to say under socialism, you've got no, people are going to be lazy. They're not going to work. I say the opposite. I say you're going to see people work 10 times harder because that work is for other people. It's for their family. It's for their relatives. It's for the person next door. It's for the people in your community. It's for people in general, for humanity. I think people understand the argument about humanity pretty well. You know, I think people can overcome nationalism. They can overcome slitting their own throat, so to speak, for capitalism by internalizing capitalist values and so on. I know people can overcome that stuff. I've seen it happen, right? Even under capitalism. But it's really got to happen and really going to happen when there's a replacement to the economic system where labor is used and natural resources are used in a coordinated, planned, democratically planned way to create better living standards for everyone on the planet. And that's the essence of socialism. Bring democracy into economics, which it doesn't exist under capitalism. It's a very strict hierarchy of a very strict oligarchy, very strict capitalist chain of command under capitalism, and only the few at the top will really benefit. And if you really want to look at the big picture, you know, those few at the top, as far as a class goes, their days are numbered, either through the what they're doing to the planet, some sort of nuclear war will get ticked off or triggered, or there will be environmental disasters will continue to worsen. But they don't care, because for capitalists, even if you're a nice person and you're a capitalist, in order to survive as a capitalist, you must worship the god of capitalism. What is the god of capitalism? Short-term maximization of profit. And whether you're a privately held company or a publicly held company, if you do not live by the rules of that god, then, and that the greed that comes from that emanates from that, by the way, if you do not live by those rules, you will be taken over. You will be forced out by other capitalists, by bigger capitalists, by even the government can come in. There's actually rules of incorporation in this country that, and other countries, of course, anywhere under capitalism, that protect individual capitalists from personal liability in a lot of situations, right? And that if the company goes under, that's the company, not them. They're not going to have their wealth stripped and divided up amongst the workers or anything. It's just going to be, oh, the company went out of business. Shucks, I'll just go to my other company that I'm in this. You know, CEO, chief executive officers, people that are on corporate boards are often on the corporate board of more than one company. Say it's a privately held company, right? No stock, privately held, one corporate board. Still could be the case of interlocking corporate boards. And still the case that you can be taken over or forced out, more is likely. You can be bought up, but if you refuse to sell, you'll be forced out. And through the constant concentration of capital, constant monopolization that happens under capitalism. And so in order to remain a capitalist, you have to do what capitalists do. And that is anything but nice, anything but altruistic. It's not got nothing to do with solidarity. It's nothing to do with keeping humanity going, despite the way we're brainwashed about that. It's got to do with the idle rich, the social parasites of the world, the corporate, the super rich that run the corporation and so on, basically worshiping the god of short-term maximization of profit. As long as those profits are coming in and they're exponentially increasing, as long as they're increasing, the rate of profit is increasing, not just aggregate profits, then they will continue to invest in that thing, whatever it is. And invest is probably the wrong word. It's too nice a word. They will continue the exploitation of labor and nature in the pursuit of short-term maximization profit of whatever commodities make that situation happen for them. And if it's a harmful commodity, they'll continue with the harmful commodity. If it's, but see, the problem is it's not just the harmful commodity. It's not just things that hurt us. It's the way the commodity is produced. Even a good commodity, the way it's produced under capitalism, hurts us. Say you're producing, perfume, right? Or flowers, right? Well, look at the cut flower industry. Really look at that. The exploitation, the damage to the environment that goes along with that is horrific, right? But also the money used from that industry is not going to stay there. It's going to go to other things, you know, and the way they're produced, even if they look nice and seem nice, it's going to be harmful production. It's like Harvard University, going back to that example, right? What's wrong with education? Nothing. I loved being at college, to be honest with you. I loved it. I mean, there's pressures, right? How am I going to pay for it year to year, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot, how am I, you know, getting good grades to justify the amount of money for my family, the amount of money that we were borrowing, or the amount of money that was at stake, or having a future, quote unquote, under capitalism. Lots of pressure. And it's even more now than when I went to school. It's even more now. There's less grants available now. Scholarships don't go as far. Loans are more usurious than they were, although it took me 13 years to pay off very little loans that I had because I got rotten jobs out of college. Again, partially because I didn't want to exploit other people, but whatever. It wasn't just a moral thing. It was a thing that happened because I graduated into a recession. But the other thing is that also they don't really pay a lot for my skill set coming out, as they say, coming out of college, which is if you want to put my skill set on a resume, it would really come down to likes to read. You know, that's so if you can give me a job where I just read all day and don't bother me and don't make me like use that for your nefarious ends. Remember that CIA thriller, quote unquote, with Robert Redford, and the name is escaping me, but just look up Robert Redford. It's set in the 60s and based on a novel I actually read as well, where he's a researcher for the CIA, and these people really exist. I met one time, and they all they do is research, of course. But then of course the research and the little reports they produce are used to kill people and put in horrible governments and repressive governments, keep capitalism going worldwide and all that kind of thing. So it's really, really horrible stuff, but you know, there you go. And so he's running around like freaking out because they're trying to kill him, and he's like, they're like, what do you do? Why do they want to kill you? I don't know. I just read. I'm a reader. So I always thought of that. But like, well, yeah, he read stuff, but yeah, then he interpreted it or let other people interpret it for really horrible ends. And so you're not safe. You're just, you know, even if I could get someone to hire me for, you know, likes to read. You know, likes to listen to music too. Yes. They'll find a way to mess with that, you know, under capitalism. But back to the point, why? Ask yourself, why are the people that do no work? I know we're told they do work, but they really don't. They really hire other people for it, for the most part. The big capitalists, why are the idle rich? Why are the super rich in control in a society that runs on the work of working people? Makes no sense. It's topsy-turvy world. It's not right. So if you're worried about that happening under socialism, it's not going to happen. Under socialism, where does the, instead of coercion, instead of fear, what makes you get up every day and do some work? Because you see the results of it right away in your own life. The more you work, the more leisure time you're going to have. I know that sounds like a contradiction, but what it means is the more value we create in a planned economy, not for profit, but for human need, the more we'll be able to introduce automation, the more we'll be able to introduce ways of working that will be shared out to everybody. So you'll be doing actually less work as an individual and more time to participate in decision-making, into figuring things out. What's good for my family? What's good for my community? What's good for this area, region of the world? What's good for the world? Be part of that process. That's going to be, yeah, that takes time. If you want to participate, that's a good thing to participate in. So what if there's some lazy people that are social? They really just don't want to work. What do? Throw them all in prison or something? No, you don't have to. They're going to be such a minority. They're, you know, you're going to see, like, if you work under democratic socialism, you're going to see, like, things improve so much. That's going to be the result. That's going to be the thing that motivates you. Things are better for me, better for everyone I know. You know, you see the results right in front of you in terms of your city, your town, your home, you know, the whole bit. Enormous resources freed up from the waste and the pollution and the greed of capitalism. You know, enormous resources, enormous amounts of land, enormous abilities, flourishing of talent, hobbies become vocations, you know, boom. And then you still have these people that are holding up, you know, maybe it's the old capitalist class who are numerically insignificant. Maybe it's the people just, you know, they're still living in the past society. Maybe there's a few anomalous people that just can't, you know, understand, don't want to understand